ברוך אתה אדוני, אלוהינו מלך העולם, אשר קידשנו במצוותיו וציוונו לעסוק בדברי תורה. אמן. All right, so we got up to... Did we get up to 16?
I think we did that paragraph.
16?
Above it.
Above it, yeah, okay. All right, so let's start reading at 16. And we'll read through to verse 20 on the next page. Marilyn, would you read for us, please?
Then Moses inquired about the goat of purgation offering, and it had already been burned. He was angry with Eleazar and Ithamar, Aaron's remaining sons, and said, "Why did you not eat the purgation offering in the sacred area? For it is most holy, and it is what was given to you to remove the guilt of the community and to make expiation for them before the Eternal. Since its blood was not brought inside the sanctuary, you should certainly have eaten it in the sanctuary, as I commanded." And Aaron spoke to Moses, "See, this day they brought their purgation offering and their burnt offering before the Eternal, and such things have befallen me. Had I eaten the purgation offering today, would the Eternal have approved?" And when Moses heard this, he approved.
Okay. So, we've got two offerings going on here. What are the two offerings? And what are they referring to? Well, there's two sets of sons.
The ones who already died, and then the remaining two.
Right. Mm-hmm. And each of the sets of sons brings an offering. Okay. Now, in this case, Eleazar and Ithamar, what offering are they bringing? The purgation offering. Right? Mm-hmm. And what's the problem?
Didn't it say they let it burn up?
It's already been burned.
It already been burned. And they didn't eat it.
It's in the right area.
Right. It was not in the right area. They didn't eat it, etc. Okay.
Seems like the problem of these two sons is the same as the problem with the other son.
Well, let's see if it's the same. Because, well, there's some problem with how they offer the sacrifice. That much it's shared with the other two sons. Is the nature of their error, mistake, transgression the same? So let's look at the two sets of offerings.
Well, nothing happened to them, so evidently...
So,
well, they were told to bring an offering. The other ones were not told. They brought an offering that wasn't requested.
That would be point one. This is an offering that is required or requested. So that's right. But they don't do it correctly, right?
So the first set of sons, they had not been requested to bring an offering. I thought they just timed it wrong. They just kind of jumped the gun a little bit.
Well,
that's what I was just wondering.
Some people might interpret it that way. It was... Minimally, it was done when it was not requested to be done. Mm-hmm. Okay? But it may not have been requested at all.
Okay.
So there's some question here about responding to God's request as it's articulated by Moses. So that would be point number one. What else?
I don't know, but Aaron's argument seems pretty poor. Had I eaten it, would the Eternal have approved? And so what difference does that make? Who did it? The act itself?
Isn't that an interesting question? Now, does it matter who offers the sacrifice or not? Does it just matter how it's done or when it's done? Or does it matter who does it?
It seems to matter who offers it.
It does seem to matter who does it. Right? In what sense? I mean, it would...
If Aaron had done the same thing, it would have been okay.
Why? I mean, Moses approves of that, right?
Yeah.
He's somehow more qualified.
But the argument that Aaron is making is not that he would have done it differently.
Mm-hmm. But it's just that it would have been he instead of...
Right. So what... Why does it make a difference? Why... Wouldn't it have been just as problematic if Aaron had done it? Clearly it wasn't, but why not?
When you're more experienced, you earn the ability to break the rules.
Yeah, that's sometimes true, sure, yeah.
Like Obama cutting in line.
Just like him.
Have you ever seen the movie Mr. Holland's Opus?
Yes.
Okay. There's a scene in that movie where the Richard Dreyfuss character, Mr. Holland, is very new at the school, and he's waiting in the lunch line to get his lunch. And the football coach, who becomes his best friend eventually, pulls him out of the line and walks with him to the front of the line, and he says, "Teachers don't wait in line for lunch. High school is not a democracy." Okay.
Okay.
And because they have a certain status. There's certain perks, certain allowances that are made for that thing. For example, I bring a drink into the chapel. Not supposed to. So there's a sign on the door that says, "No food or drink in the chapel." I used to leave my drink outside on the table, and then I forget who it was, Jennifer Smith or Marilyn, somebody said, "You can bring it in."
Mm-hmm.
Now, I could bring it in. You couldn't bring it in. But
I do.
Well, once I do it, then you can do it, you see. All right. Which is, of course, one of the problems of about people having special status. Yeah.
But more than just perks or privilege, it seems to also must have something to do with the level of expertise or experience.
Could be.
Because they're the priests, you know, they've been doing this, and as opposed to the sons, or, you know, they just have more experience.
Well, you know, one of the hallmarks of a priestly religion is that there's always a kind of hierarchy. Mm-hmm. You don't get to jump levels, okay? All priests start out as novices, just like nuns and so forth do, and then they move up the ladder, and they get to higher and higher levels until finally they are in a position where they can conduct mass. You know, a junior priest doesn't get to conduct the mass unless, you know, somebody's sick or something like that. Why is that? Because the junior priest doesn't know how to do it? No. Because it is a perk, if you want to call it that, of being a senior person. You hang around and you get to be able to do certain things that you wouldn't be able to do otherwise. And that is the nature of a priestly system. Priestly systems are all about hierarchy. They function because there is a hierarchy that is in place, that they are a part of. And the hierarchy includes what? Or whom?
God.
Yeah, God's at the top of the hierarchy. And the link between God and human beings is through this hierarchy, and most directly to whom?
The prophet?
The high priest. No, this is a priestly system. Prophets are on the other side. The prophet.
Isn't Moses a prophet?
Moses is both.
Oh, but
mostly he is a prophet and not a priest. It's sort of split between him and Aaron, okay? But he comes from a priestly family, ostensibly. Remember we talked last time
mm-hmm.
about
whether he did.
Whatever mm-hmm. he did. So Aaron is, and his descendants are the hierarchy. And it's Aaron who is designated by God to be the head of the priestly ladder, so to speak. So who is it who gets the imprimatur of God to conduct these rites? It's Aaron. He's the top guy. So you don't sort of jump the order. If Aaron's around, Aaron gets to do it. When Aaron gets too old or when Aaron dies, then you move up and everybody moves up one notch. That's how the priestly system works. And the reason it works that way is priestly religion is about a kind of chain or kind of ladder that step by step links people at the bottom of the ladder with God at the top of the ladder. Okay? Where do we know this from besides religion?
business.
Okay, how?
Well, I mean, you start in the mailroom.
That's true, okay.
And there's a CEO at the top, generally.
Right.
And you up until very recently, the corporate ladder was called a ladder.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And you worked your way up, and if you stayed with the company, you would move up over time, and you would get better opportunities,
right.
And you would get to, when I started work, I didn't get to go to Japan for depositions.
Of course not.
I stayed back in the document
room. That was a perk of somebody who was more
right.
senior. Yeah.
Exactly.
But who is in the position of God in that analogy?
Sometimes the board of directors.
Maybe the board of directors, or maybe the...
Maybe the CEO.
Or maybe the stockholders.
Or maybe the stockholders.
You know, there's somebody who authorizes all of this. Okay? As opposed to the chairman of the board, there's the president of the corporation. President of the corporation is an appointed position employee. Chairman of the board is a stockholder who owns part of the company. The
president
may not
be fired. Makes them
exactly exactly. So there's a distinction there, but it still holds true.
In our college, it was the board of directors, and they hired and fired the chancellor.
Sure, so. Chancellor, as important as he is an employee. Hired and fired by the board. That's how it works. In most synagogues, same thing is true of the rabbi. Mm-hmm. The rabbi, though he or she is supposed to be the spiritual leader of the congregation, in reality is an employee of the congregation and serves at the pleasure of the board, which is one of the problems with the organization of both congregations, if you ask
me. They had a big problem at the Buddhist temple in Missouri because the rabbi who was, the priest who was from didn't acknowledge this kind of board. And he thought he was the most powerful because he was the one with the most knowledge. And so
well,
half
from
the
a certain point
left.
Of view, he's supposed to be. That's the mythos of the synagogue or of other kinds of the priest in the church or whatever it may be. But in reality...
In America, especially.
In America. Well, you know, it's true in the Catholic Church in Europe or Catholic Church in general. You get put where you get put, and there's somebody above you who puts you there, and there's somebody above him who puts him there, and so on and so forth, all the way up to the...
So could the Pope be taken out by the same group that...
No, that's why it's a lifetime position.
Oh, so he... Not
can't.
There, not
he can recuse himself or retire the way the last guy did.
But that's
which
very
is,
odd.
That was very odd and very unusual. Usually the guy dies in office. And why is that? Because he is here's the expression, the vicar of Christ on earth. Well, does anybody know what the word vicar means? He's the official representative. Hmm. Okay? If you go to... an English church, Church of England, the actual English one, what's the person who's the head of the parish called?
The vicar.
He's the vicar, because he is the official representative of the church.
But if memory serves, having been a Jane Austen person back in my youth,
yes,
the vicar serves at the whim of the landholder very often.
Ah, this is a very difficult kind of question. This is the question of the Reformation, okay? One of the things that Luther was protesting against, among the, 50-some-odd items on his list, one of the problems was the conflict between secular and ecclesiastical authority. In a particular area. And by the way, Judaism has this as well. In the Bible, for sure, you have the king and the priests, or later on, king and the priests and the prophets, or later on, the king and the prophets, as the priests drop out, who are vying for ultimate authority. And, you know, those kind of conflicts happen all the time. Well, here's another example, though. How about the military?
Mm-hmm. Well, the president's the top cat.
Mm-hmm. The president is the top cat. He's the commander-in-chief. Mm-hmm. and he and his advisors set policy. The Congress is also important. They apportion the money.
And they have the power to get rid of the president. They could impeach him.
Yes, only for high crimes and misdemeanors, very exceptionally, but yes, it is possible. Or they think they can sue the president.
Yeah.
This is going to be funny. All right, so anyway, but then you have the, what do you call it? You call it the, not the ladder, but the
chain
of command, which is the same idea as the ladder. There's, as you have rung all the way up, so now you've got link in the chain, link in the chain, link. Okay? So that's what a hierarchical system is about, and the priestly system is a hierarchical system. You mentioned the prophets. They are very distinguished, from all this, because prophets are about spontaneity. They're not about a hierarchy. They're about God intervening in regular events in a spontaneous, exceptional sort of way. Okay? And so and that's why prophets are thorns in the side of the priests and the kings. Because they show up someday and say, by the way, what you're doing is wrong, says God. This is the way we've always done it. Well, yeah, but God spoke to me and God said, no, you're not doing it right. Or whatever it may be. So I mentioned
kind
this before.
Like grandparents are more like prophets as opposed to priests are like the parents.
Yeah, that's true. There's a certain...
They intermittently step in and say something.
Yeah, and often when they're not wanted by the parents.
Yeah.
Right. So on the one hand, you have this hierarchical system. Everything moves step by step. Everything's about form. Everything's about discipline and order. And then you have the prophets who, you know, at any moment could say something to upset the apple cart. Okay. This is the way that human beings function in the world. We move between these two poles. And society moves between those poles. You know, on the one hand, we want government to be organized. We want it to be predictable. We want to know what people are going to do and what the principles are and what the rules are. And we want to follow the rules so that everybody gets treated equally and fairly and the same. On the other hand, we think sometimes that there are exceptions. Usually we are the exception. or there are others that we think are the exception, and we have no patience for the order and the hierarchy of the bureaucracy and so on and so forth. At the same time, one of the virtues of priestly or hierarchical religion is because it is predictable and orderly, it is accessible. You know exactly what you have to do. This is the day in which I bring this sacrifice. If I bring this sacrifice, I'm okay. God's not going to all of a sudden say, and by the way, you have to bring two sacrifices. Ha ha ha. Okay? That doesn't happen. On the prophetic side, you could be doing something the way you've always done it, and the prophet comes along and says, you know, that's not the sacrifice that I demand, says God. Okay? You think, well, I've been bringing the sacrifices the way I've been told all these years, and now you're telling me that this is not what God wants all of a sudden? I've been doing it wrong all this time? Well, yeah, you have. and that's that allows for the flash of insight, for the new understanding, revelation, if you want to call it that. That's on the prophetic side, not on the priestly side. Priests don't have revelations. Priests have predictability.
Order.
Yeah, order and predictability. Prophets have revelations. So, that's all by way of saying that one of the problems here may be that Eleazar and Itamar are bringing a sacrifice that God wants, unlike their older brothers. But They are short-circuiting the hierarchy. That it's not their place to bring the sacrifice, it's Aaron's place to do it. And when Aaron is no longer able to do it or whatever, then it's their job. But right
but
now
that
it's
wasn't
not.
The criticism. The criticism was the timing of it.
Well,
not that they had brought it.
Well, one of the points of criticism is that Aaron asked, if I had done this, would it be successful, acceptable? And the answer was yes. So part of it is the question of who does it. Now, on the other side, there is a question of when it gets done. And what
where?
Is the,
why did you not
eat and where?
In the sacred area?
Right. Now, what is the problem with a sacrifice that is not done in the sacred area? Well, first of all, let's talk about who gets to be in the sacred area.
Mm-hmm.
Who? Can anybody observe it?
No.
No.
Who?
Mm-mm. Only the priests who have been ordained and...
Yeah, it's an inside sprinkled. Kind of thing.
Right.
All right? It's not meant to be observed by the people as a whole. Now, one of the things about priestly religion is that it's a, that at its center, it is about a certain kind of access to for a broad range of people in prescribed and authorized ways. But at each level in the hierarchy, there are some people who are excluded and some people who are included, and gradually the this becomes a pyramid until finally at the very highest level only the high priest and
sounds
only
like
on the
sounds like Scientology.
Well, it is a hallmark of any priestly system, and it's not just Scientology. I'll give you an example. Marianne Williamson and the Course on Miracles.
Who is that? She's running for Congress now. But
oh, is she? Yeah.
Yeah, she's running in California.
Her niece lives here in Austin, Amber DeFord. Do you know her?
No.
Yeah. And you know Marianne Williamson is Jewish.
No, I did not know that.
Yes,
but she's
she is.
A self-help guru, okay. Oprah friend type person.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very, she's very successful.
Context.
She has something called the Course in Miracles. Okay. So I guarantee you that the only person in the world who is authorized to uncover further truths in the Course in Miracles is Marianne Williamson. If you buy the book and you read it, you are not entitled to say that this is what the book means. You can say it to yourself if you like. You can interpret it to yourself. But Marianne Williamson is in control of what the Course in Miracles means. It happens in all sorts of fields. Here's an example that you wouldn't normally expect. Who is in charge of the theory of low-carb diets in the United States? There's one person who's in charge of this.
Atkins?
No, Atkins is high protein, low carb.
Oh, high protein.
High protein. Yeah. Dean Ornish.
Oh, yes.
Really?
Oh, if Dean Ornish says it, it's true. If somebody else says it, maybe or maybe not.
I didn't realize.
Oh, yes. Nice Jewish boyfriend.
I grew up with him.
Yeah,
his father was my dentist.
Yeah. Yeah, he is crazy. I know. He's a nut.
I'm saying, no.
Yeah.
No, he just, go ahead. But you know, he kind of latched on to something that a lot of people, you know, with the visualization and the reversal of the, you know, and he's a big proponent of things that Hillary Clinton has followed and all this kind of, you know.
Yeah, yeah. All I'm saying is that unofficially, if Dean Ornish doesn't pass on it, in terms
he's
of the high-carb, low-protein people, low-fat people, it doesn't count, okay? And similarly, you on the other side, used to be Atkins. He's dead now, so I don't know who it is on the high-protein, low-carb side, but there's probably somebody like that who's taking that position. And again, as you move up the ladder, people's authority becomes more concentrated, and the number of people becomes narrower. That's just how it works. So in the United States Senate and Congress, you have what's called the seniority system. Does anybody know how the seniority system works? No? Sure you do.
Really?
Yeah. When you come in as a freshman representative or senator, now all these guys come in and they say, I'm going to change this and I'm going to change that. What they discover, of course, is that they become low man on the totem pole in some obscure committee with little or no impact on anything. And it will take them years to work their way up in the committee system to be the chairman of that lowly committee or to move on to a more important committee. And gradually, step by step, the longer you stay, the higher the committee assignment is that you have and the more senior on the committee you are, until eventually you get to be the whip or the majority leader or the speaker and so on. That's how it works in the Congress. Very much like a priesthood. You want to know why things don't move in Washington, D.C.? That's a major reason. Because that kind of system is not set up to make changes.
And it's the young people who will make the newcomers.
Right.
Well, but also, when you combine that, in that particular case, if you consider that each congressperson is a local priest.
Yeah.
And you consider that each local priest is, in fact, a priest for life, given certain gerrymandering and districting rules that have been put into place, so that there is no incentive for them to do anything other than toe the line they've always towed.
Right. And the more that that's true, the more power each succeeding level up the chain has, because they are better able to control who gets access to the next level. Okay? It's a dastardly system, which has gotten worse and worse in the last 10 or 15 years. And it is not the only reason, but it is an important reason why nothing actually can happen in Washington. The seniority system used to be much looser than it has become in recent years. And that's a real problem. Okay.
But, you know, I find that that's true in all social situations. And I think, you know, whether you get involved with women's division or the women's organizations, the people who've been there the longest control the policy, and, you know, newcomers, you know, although they want newcomers, they want things to always be done the way they were done.
Right. Yeah, that's true. I don't disagree with that. There are people, though, who are ready to rebel constantly.
Yes.
And, you know, so there's always
especially
a tension.
Jewish organizations.
Well, yes, Jewish organizations are notorious for this. But, yeah, these are two competing impulses. And, you know, that's why you have leadership battles along generational lines in synagogues all the time. Not just synagogues. Churches have the same problem. The people who've been around for a while and run things for a while will say, I am ready to have somebody take over my position. I'm tired. I want to get out of this. And then as soon as somebody comes in and wants to do things differently, they get upset. Well, what did they expect? But the idea that you want people new to come in, but you want them to do things without any changes, that's a kind of a non-starter. That's what we people are.
I understand the conversation you're having, but I still don't think I understand what this section of the Torah is saying to us.
Okay.
Now, can I ask a point of clarification?
Sure.
So this sacrifice that they were asked to do was in response to the death of the first two sons, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So they were told, you can't do the mourning the normal way. You're
right.
Not renting your clothes, but you're going to make this offering, right? And you're going to do this in here. And then there's some stuff that we read And Moses tells him what to do, and then he gets upset because the goat got burned.
Yeah, but it didn't get burned where it was supposed to get burned. This didn't take place in the inner sanctuary. Now, what's the problem with that? Well, the first problem with that is that that is a level of access that the average person is not supposed to have. This is a kind of moving beyond the boundary that's not supposed to be breached, okay? And this is a hallmark of a priestly system. You don't, there's a level, certain kind of access that you get on the bottom, and you get the access shifts to the next level, shifts to the next level, and so forth.
Did this happen because the sons weren't, you know, didn't have a swipe card to get into the executive suite?
Ah.
Do you see something? They might have been used to performing lower level sacrifices in the sanctum area, but not the sanctum area.
Yes.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. And why would it make a difference then if it was Aaron?
Well, because Aaron would have been able to get in there and do it. But they didn't. They hadn't been anointed yet or elevated yet.
Yeah. So we're dealing with a sacrifice that was not appropriate for these folks to do, however much they wanted to do it.
So but weren't they told to do it?
They were told, the priests were told to bring this offering. It doesn't say that Eleazar and Itamar are supposed to do it.
Okay.
But the point is, who does it and where it's done matters. Okay? What we're saying then, in the priestly system, intention is trumped by discipline, okay? Unlike the prophetic system, where intention is really the top thing, okay? The spontaneous, well-meaning insight for the prophet is more important than the regular routine, the bureaucratic behavior of the institution. For the priests, the regular observance of the rules is what's paramount. So in the first instance, we deal with whether or not you can take on to yourself offering a sacrifice which has not been authorized altogether. In the second instance, we're dealing with a sacrifice which has been authorized, but not for those individuals and not in the place. Okay? Now, here's where it's kind of the rubber meets the road, okay? There, in our day, the priestly side of things is denigrated. You know, I've got to be me, you know, it's the usual kind of thing. And the spontaneous, the heartfelt, the inner, and so on and so forth, is the most meaningful. But there is a real problem with religion that is centered on that. And the problem is that unless you are what you might call a spiritual adept, somebody who is especially spiritually sensitive and able to have such insights and such intense devotional connections, you're left out in the cold. The average person who is not like that has no chance of doing what God wants.
It's better to have something prescribed that you can
follow. Well, the truth is you need to have both. But you have to have a vehicle for the average person who is not an Isaiah, who is not a King David, who is not a Rabbi Akiba, who nonetheless, within the capabilities of that they have, is able to discharge what God regards as their obligations or what their spiritual requirements are, and fulfill them without being able to do all this kind of stuff. They don't have to be able to have the same insight that, I don't know who, Martin Luther King had. I mean, sometimes people have visions like that. It's wonderful. What do you do if you're not that kind of person? Are you consigned to the slag heap of spiritual history just because you're not King David? So there is a democratic, small d, democratic aspect to the priestly system which makes it available to the average Joe or Josephine, who otherwise would simply have no standing at all. On the other hand, you know, if you're an Akiba, that would like bore you out of your mind, or King David or whoever. And an advance in terms of insight and spiritual revelation and so forth would never be made. So you have to have the other side, the prophetic side, where that kind of thing is valued and encouraged and even set up to happen. Okay? But you can't make that the prerequisite for everybody else. So you've got two tracks going on here. You've got the track which is the track that is meant for the average person. Okay. You go to shul on Shabbos and you pray with everybody, and sometimes you have, you know, a really meaningful spiritual experience, and sometimes it's just you're happy to say hello to your friends, whatever it may be, and you know, sometimes it clicks, sometimes it doesn't click, and that's okay. And then there are other days and other people for whom, you know, it's a day of devotion and it's intense and it's very meaningful and it's revelatory and so on and so forth. And for them, going to shul is something more than just going there and singing the songs and, you know, having challah and whatever it happens to be. But you can't have a spiritual community unless the people whose capability ends at singing a camp song that they remember for blessing of challah, and say to them, and by the way, what you are doing doesn't count. That's not good. So that's kind of what's going on here. And we're dealing with the second level. We dealt with the first level of doing something which is unauthorized altogether. Now we're doing the question of who is authorized and where it's authorized. Okay? And the answer is very clear here, in my opinion. Aaron, who is directly authorized by God, he's the head of this hierarchy, this ladder, he's at the top rung, and he's accessible to go into the sacred space and so on and so forth, as you have pointed out. He's the one who should have been doing this. And later on, it'll be Eleazar's and Itamar's turn, but right now it's not. All right. So Eleazar and Itamar may be unhappy about that, and that comes under the heading of hard cheese. Okay? From the standpoint of the priestly side of things, none of this is personal. None of this is idiosyncratic. It's all positional. It's all defined by place. Okay? And what is personally meaningful to you doesn't come into play. I mean, it can, but it's not what the requirement is. Okay, yeah.
Well, I get the impression that if Moses hadn't have said okay, that there might have been punishment for these two boys.
Well, in this case, I think that you're on the right track there, Kim. I would tweak it a little bit. I would say, look, Aaron here intervenes in a way that he was not able to intervene, or if you prefer, he didn't choose to intervene in the case of his two elder sons. Because these guys, Eleazar and Itamar, have some grounding for what they did. The sacrifice was done correctly. It just wasn't done in the right place.
And by the right people.
But the sacrifice itself, we have no inkling in the text that they did it incorrectly. Okay.
Well, but he was angry because they burned it instead of eating it, I thought.
Well, they were not entitled to eat it.
Oh, they burned it because that was what their pay grade told them to do.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So they didn't do anything that, in terms of the sacrifice and stuff, that they weren't supposed to do.
Okay.
But they were not supposed to do anything about it. It was really Aaron's thing to do. And they were not able to do it in the right place. See, here's the interesting thing. Let's say that Eleazar and Itamar felt it was like personally meaningful to them to do this sacrifice. Maybe they felt they wanted to atone for their brothers. Maybe they felt that their brothers had brought a stain upon the family escutcheon, you know. Maybe they felt they wanted to make up for something in some way. And so out of some kind of personal, meaningful desire, they decided to do this. Well, that was not necessarily a bad thing by itself. It just didn't allow them to do it in the way that they should have done it. It should have been done, I should put it that way. I guess you would say that this is a case where Aaron really was as much at fault, if there was anybody at fault, as his sons were. Where was he during this whole business? Why didn't he do the sacrifice? Why did he allow his sons to do it? Well, this is a very human thing, okay? How many times do you have an incident where your kid really wants to do something and you know that it's really not right, or they're really not ready, or they're really not in a position to do it, but they will just not be denied. They want to do it. And you say, well, you know, they want to do something good. They want to do something that is meaningful and valuable. Maybe I should support this.
And you know they might get burned, too.
Well, you know, what do we say? You got to learn. And experience is the best teacher, you know. So maybe Aaron thought, you know what, I'll give in on this. This is not the battle I'm gonna fight. I don't know, it happens in my family all the time.
I think it's more that Aaron was still, whether God wanted him to be or not, he's in mourning. His older two sons are dead.
Yes.
And he probably was, he didn't say anything, so you get kind of a feeling that he's frozen.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Maybe incapable of taking action.
Could be.
And maybe his sons were being compassionate to him. Dad, let us take care of this. We'll do it.
Right, and that's a possibility. I like
which
that
is
a lot.
Which is why Aaron would then come in and say, hey.
Would it have been okay if I had done it? Yeah, well, that may be true. I mean, you can imagine from an emotional or psychological point of view, there could be a number of reasons why the sons were taken with or given the freedom to do the sacrifice. But here's another side of the hierarchical or priestly approach to religion. Your personal distress, your personal emotional idiosyncratic position is not relevant. You are discharging an office. And it doesn't matter if you are in a good mood or a bad mood, whether you are happy or sad, whether you agree or you don't agree, none of that matters if you're on that side of the equation. Okay? If you are a bureaucrat at the Department of Motor Vehicles and you're having a bad day, you're not allowed to bark at the person who comes up next in line. You can't do it. You just don't have that freedom. You have to give the person their license, you have to take their photograph, you have to do all the things that you're required to do, whether you feel like it or you don't.
Technically.
That's right. Well, okay. All right. Fair enough. But my point, I think, is that you're supposed to do that,
right.
Okay? And there's no good excuse that should be accepted for not following through on that, okay? All right, you're homesick. It's a different story. But otherwise, that's what you're supposed to do. So, I mean, what I'm saying is that the personal drops out of one side The other side, the prophetic side, is all personal. It's all about the personal relationship of the prophet with God. It's an exclusive relationship. It is highly idiosyncratic. It is marked by being, you might even say, unique. And in fact, what you know, you read the literature of mystical experiences, let's say, what is acknowledged by everybody is that it is impossible for the person who is the receiver, the beneficiary of the mystical experience, to relate that in any coherent way, in any full coherent way, to somebody who has not had that experience. That's how idiosyncratic and personal it is. Okay? Nobody at the Department of Motor Vehicles has a personal experience like that of getting their picture taken for a license. It's a ridiculous idea. Okay? It's, you know, you go to your post office and you want to buy some stamps. You do not have an eye-to-eye relationship with the postal clerk. It's ridiculous. In fact, you know what? In our little post office near our house, they do a lot of passports. And if you go there often enough, you hear the little spiel that the postal clerks do when they're going through the process of giving somebody a passport. And you get a real lesson in what it means to be a bureaucrat. I mean, there's certain words that are said, certain words that are returned, so on and so forth. That's just the way it is. And you don't deviate. Now, you say, okay, is that a bad way to have religion? Is that a meaningful way to have religion? It's what allows you to have religious institutions at all. And you have to have institutional life to have communal life. So you're kind of struck between a rock and a hard place. You have both sides of the equation.
We don't have prophets now, do we, in Judaism?
Ah.
Well, much hierarchy.
Well, yeah, we don't have much of either, do we?
That's why it's so hard to sometimes relate to all this, because it doesn't seem like Judaism.
We need to stop, but I'll say one other thing before we leave for today. I think that the hierarchies that exist are hidden.
Mm-hmm. Not as obvious.
I think they exist, but they are somewhat more amorphous. That is true. But they exist, and they are meant to be beneath the surface, because there is a public ideology of democracy, that a kind of democracy that is not compatible with this hierarchical view of things. And so we have to pretend that there is no hierarchy, or that it's very limited, or something like that. All right, we gotta stop there. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you all very much.